drowning, and the mermaid plans to take his heart for herself. Take it and eat it in hopes that it might turn her into what he is. Fins to legs, fish to something more. She'll steal the thing I need to win back my mother's favor. I'm so furious that I don't even think before I reach out and sink my nails into the mermaid's skull. In shock, the creature releases the prince and he floats back to the surface. I tighten my grip. The mermaid thrashes and scratches at my hands, but her strength is nothing compared to that of a siren's. Especially mine. Especially when I have my sights on a kill. My fingers press deeper into the mermaid's skull and disappear inside her rainbow flesh. I can feel the sharp bone of her skeleton. The mermaid stills, but I don't stop. I dig my fingers deeper and pull. Her head falls to the ocean floor. I think about bringing it to my mother as a trophy, sticking it on a pike outside of the Quito Palace as a warning to all mermaids who would dare challenge a siren. But the Sea Queen wouldn't approve. Mermaids are her subjects, lesser beings are not. I take one last disdainful look at the creature, and then swim to the surface in search of my prince. I spot him quickly, on the edge of a small patch of sand by the docks. He's coughing so violently that the act shakes his entire body. He spits out great gasps of water and then collapses onto his stomach. I swim as close to shore as I can and then pull myself the rest of the way until only the tip of my fin is left in the shallows of the water. I reach out and grab the prince's ankle, dragging him down so his body is level with mine. I nudge his shoulder, and when he doesn't move, I roll him onto his back. Sand sticks to the gold of his cheeks, and his lips part ever so slightly, wet with ocean. He looks half dead already. His shirt clings to his skin, blood seeping through the slashes the mermaid tore. His chest barely moves with his breath. And if I couldn't hear the faint sound of his heart, then I would think for certain he was nothing more than a beautiful corpse. I press a hand to his face and draw a fingernail from the corner of his eye to his cheek. A thin red line bubbles above his skin, but he doesn't stir. His jaw is so sharp it could cut through me. Slowly, I reach under his shirt and press a hand against his chest. His heart thumps desperately beneath my palm. I lean my head against it and listen to the drumming with a smile. I can smell the ocean on him, an unmistakable salt, but mingled beneath it all is the faint aroma of aniseed. He smells like the black sweets of the anglers, the saccharine oil they use to lure their catch. I find myself wishing him awake so I can catch a glimpse of those seaweed eyes before I take his heart and give it to my mother. I lift my head from his chest and hover my hand over his heart. My nails clutch his skin, and I prepare to plunge my fist deeper.
Your Highness!
I snap my head up. A legion of royal guards runs across the docks and toward us. I look back to the prince, and his eyes begin to open. His head lolls in the sand, and then his gaze focuses on me. His eyes narrow as he takes in the color of my hair and the single eye that matches. He doesn't look worried that my nails are dug into his chest or scared by his impending death. Instead, he looks resolute and oddly satisfied. I don't have time to think about what that means. The guards are fast approaching, screaming for their prince, guns and swords at the ready, all of them pointed at me. I glance down at the prince's chest once more, and the heart I came so close to winning. Then quicker than light, I dart back to the ocean, and away from him.
11. Elium. My dreams are thick with blood that is not mine. It's never mine, because I'm as immortal in my dreams as I seem to be in real life. I'm made of scars and memories, neither of which have any real bearing. It's been 2 days since the attack, and the siren's face haunts my nights, or what little I remember of her. Whenever I try to recall a single moment, all I see are her eyes, one like sunset, and the other like the ocean I love so much, the Prince's Bane. I was half groggy when I woke on the shore, but I could have done something. Reached for the knife tucked in my belt and let it drink her blood, smashed my fist across her cheek and held her down while a guard fetched my father. I could have killed her, but I didn't. Because she's a wonder, a creature that has eluded me for so long and then, finally, appeared. Let me be privy to a face few men live to speak about. My monster found me, and I'm going to find her right back.
It's an outrage!
The king bursts into my room, red-faced. My mother floats in after him, wearing a green calasiris and an exasperated expression. When she sees me, her brow knits.
None of them can tell me a thing,
my father says.
What use are sea wardens if they don't warden the damn sea?
Darling, my mother places a gentle hand on his shoulder. They look for ships on the surface. I don't recall us telling them to swim underwater and search for sirens.
It should go without saying.
My father is incensed.
Initiative is what those men need, especially with their future king here. They should have known the sea bitch would come for him.
Radames, my mother scolds. Your son would prefer your concern to your rage. My father turns to me, as if only just noticing I'm there despite it being my room. I can see the moment he notices the line of sweat that coats my forehead and seeps from my body to the sheets. His face softens.
Are you feeling better?
He asks.
I could fetch the physician.
I'm fine. The hoarseness of my voice betrays the lie.
You don't look it.
I wave him off, hating that I suddenly feel like a child again, needing my father to protect me from the monsters. I don't imagine anyone looks their best before breakfast, I say. I bet I could still woo any of the women at court, though. My mother shoots me an admonishing look.
I'm going to dismiss them all,
my father says, continuing on as though my sickliness hadn't given him pause.
Every sorry excuse for a sea warden we have.
I lean against the headboard. I think you're overreacting.
Overreacting. You could have been killed on our own land in broad daylight.
I lift myself from bed. I sway a little, unsteady on my feet, but recover quickly enough for it to go unnoticed. I hardly blame the wardens for failing to spot her, I say, lifting my shirt from the floor. It takes a trained eye. Which is true, incidentally, though I doubt my father cares. He doesn't even seem to remember that the sea wardens watch the surface for enemy ships and are not in any way required to search underneath for devils and demons. The sod is home to the few men and women in the world mad enough to try.
Eyes like yours,
my father scoffs.
Let's just hire some of those rapscallions you ramble around with then.
My mother gleams. What a wonderful idea.
It was not,
argues my father.
I was being flippant, Isa.
Yet it was the least foolish thing I've heard you say in days. I grin at them and walk over to my father, placing a comforting hand on his shoulder. The anger disappears from his eyes, and he wears a look similar to resignation. He knows as well as I do that there is only one thing to be done, and that's for me to leave. I suspect half of my father's anger comes from knowing that. After all, my Das is a sanctuary my father spouts as a safe haven from the devils I hunt. An escape for me to return to if I ever need it. Now the attack has made a liar of him. Don't worry, I say. I'll make sure the siren suffers for it. It isn't until I speak the words that I realize how much I mean them. My home is tainted with the same danger as the rest of my life, and it doesn't sit right with me. Sirens belong in the sea, and those two parts of me, the prince and the hunter, have remained separate. I hate that their merging wasn't because I was brave enough to stop pretending and tell my parents I never plan on becoming king, and that whenever I am home, I feel like a fraud. How I think carefully about every word and action before saying or doing anything, just to be sure it is the right thing, the done thing. My two selves were thrust together because the prince's bane forced my hand. She spurred into action something I should have been brave enough to do myself all along. I hate her for it. On the deck of the Saad later that day, my crew gathers around me. 200 men and women with fury on their faces as they regard the scratch below my eye. It's the only wound they can see, though there are plenty more hidden beneath my shirt. A circle of fingernails right where my heart is. Pieces of the siren still embedded in my chest. I've given you dangerous orders in the past, I say to my crew. And you've done them without a single complaint. Well, I shoot them a grin. Most of you. A few of them smirk in Kai's direction and he salutes proudly. But this is different. I take in a breath, readying myself. I need a crew of around 100 volunteers. Really, I'll take any of you I can get. But I think you know that without some of you, the journey won't be possible at all. I look over to my chief engineer and he nods in silent understanding. The rest of the crew stares up at me with equally strong looks of fidelity. People say you can't choose your family. But I've done just that with each and every member of the Saad. I've hand-picked them all, and those who I didn't sought me out. We chose one another. Every ragtag one of us. Whatever vows of loyalty you've sworn, I won't hold you to them. Your honor isn't in question, and anyone who doesn't volunteer won't be thought any less of. If we succeed, every single member of this crew will be welcomed back with open arms when we sail again. I want to make that clear. Enough speeches, yells Kai. Get to the point so I know whether to pack my long johns. Beside him, Madrid rolls her eyes. Don't forget your purse, too. I feel laughter on my lips, but I swallow it and continue on. A few days ago, a man came to me with a story about a rare stone that has the power to kill the Sea Queen. How's it possible? Someone asks from the crowd.
It's not possible, another voice shouts.
Someone once told me that taking a crew of felons and misfits across the seas to hunt for the world's most deadly monsters wasn't possible, I say. That we'd all die within a week. I don't know about you lot, Guy says, but my heart's still beating. I shoot him a smile. The world has been led to believe the Sea Queen can't be killed by any man-made weapons, I say. But this stone wasn't made by man. It was crafted by the original families from their purest magic. If we use it, then the Sea Queen could die before she's able to pass her trident onto the prince's bane. It'll rid their entire race of any true power once and for all. Madrid steps to the front, elbowing men out of her way. Kai follows behind her, but she keeps her eyes on me with a hard stare. That's all well and good, Cap, she says. But isn't it the prince's bane who we should be worrying about? The only reason we haven't turned her to foam is because we can't find her. If we kill her mother, then she should show her face. Not to mention that it's the Queen's magic that gives the Sirens their gifts. If we destroy the Queen, they'll all be weak, including the Prince's Bane. The seas will be ours. And how do we find the Sea Queen? Kai asks. I'd follow you to the ends of the Earth, but their kingdom is in the middle of a lost sea. Nobody knows where it is.
We don't need to know where their kingdom is. We don't even need to know where the Diabolos Sea is. The only thing we need to know is how to sail to Pegos.
Pegos, Madrid says the word with a frown. You're not seriously considering that.
It's where the crystal is, I tell her. And once we have it, the Sea Queen will come to us.
So, we just head on down to the Ice Kingdom and ask the Snow Folk to hand it over?
Someone asks. I hesitate.
Not exactly. The crystal isn't in Pegos. It's on top of it.
The Cloud Mountain,
Kai clarifies for the rest of the crew.
Our captain wants us to climb to the top of the coldest mountain in the world.
One that's killed everybody who's tried.
Madrid scoffs as they start to murmur.
And, she adds, all for a mythical crystal that may or may not lead the most fearsome creature in the world to our door.
I glare at them both, unamused by the double act or the sudden doubt in their voices. This is the first time they've questioned me, and the feeling isn't something I plan to get used to.
That's the gist of it, I say.
There's a pause, and I try my best not to move or do anything but look unyielding. Like I can be trusted. Like I have any kind of a damn clue what I'm doing. Like I probably won't get them all killed.
Well?
Madrid turns to Kai.
I think it sounds like fun.
I guess you're right, he says, as though following me is an inconvenience he never considered before. He turns to me.
Count us in, then. I suppose I can spare some time, too, since you asked so nicely,
another voice shouts.
Can hardly say no to such a tempting offer, Cap.
Go on, then, if everyone else is so keen.
So many of them yell and nod, pledging their lives to me with a smile, like it's all just a game to them. With every new hand that shoots up comes a whooping holler from those who have already agreed. They howl at the possibility of death and how much company they're going to have in it. They're insane and wonderful. I'm no stranger to devotion. When people at court look at me, I see the mindless loyalty that comes with not knowing any better. Something that is natural to those who have never questioned the bizarre order of things. But when my crew looks at me now, I see the kind of loyalty that I've earned. Like I deserve the right to lead them to whatever fate I see fit. Now, there's just one thing left for me to do before we set sail for the Land of Ice.
12. Elion. The Golden Goose is the only constant in Midas. Every inch of land seems to grow and change when I'm gone, with small evolutions that never seem gradual to me. But the Golden Goose is as it has always been. It didn't plant the golden flowers outside its doors that all of the houses once did, as was fashion, with remnants of them still seen in the depths of the wildflowers that now swallow them. Nor did it erect sandy pillars or hang wind chimes or remodel its roof to point like the pyramids. It is in untouched timelessness. So whenever I return and something about my home is different, I can be sure it's never the Golden Goose, never Sakura. It's early and the sun is still a milky orange. I thought it best to visit the dregs of the Golden Goose when the rest of Midas was still sleeping. It didn't seem wise to ask a favor from its ice-born landlord, with swells of patrons drunkenly eavesdropping. I knock on the redwood door and a splinter slides into my knuckle. I withdraw it just as the door swings open. Sakura looks unsurprised on the other side.
I knew it would be you.
She peers behind me.
Isn't the tattooed one with you?
Madrid is preparing the ship, I tell her. We set sail today.
Shame.
Sakura slings a dish rag over her shoulder.
You're not nearly as pretty.
I don't argue. Can I come in?
A prince can ask for favors on a doorstep like everyone else.
Your doorstep doesn't have whiskey. Sakura smiles, her dark red lips curling to one side. She spreads her arms out, gesturing for me to come inside.
I hope you have full pockets.
I enter, keeping my eyes trained on her. It's not like I think she might try something untoward. Kill me, perhaps, right here in the Golden Goose. Not when our relationship is so profitable to her. But there is something about Sakura that has always unnerved me, and I'm not the only one. There aren't many who can manage a bar like the Golden Goose with patrons who collect sin like precious jewels. Brawls and fights are constant, and most nights spill more blood than whiskey. Yet when Sakura tells them enough, the men and women cease, adjust their respective collars, spit onto the grimy floor, and continue on with their drinks as though nothing happened at all. Arguably, she is the most fearsome woman in my desk, and I don't make a habit of turning my back on fearsome women. Sakura steps behind the bar and pours a slosh of amber liquid into a glass. As I sit opposite, she brings the glass to her lips and takes a quick sip. A print of murky red lipstick stains the rim, and I note the fortuitous timing. Sakura slides the glass over to me.
Satisfied?
She asks. She means because it isn't poisoned. I may scan the seas looking for monsters that could literally rip my heart out, but that doesn't mean I'm careless. There isn't a single thing I eat or drink when we are docked that hasn't been tasted by someone else first. Usually this duty falls to Torek, who volunteered the moment I took him aboard, and insists that he's not putting his life at risk, because even the greatest of poisons couldn't kill him. Taking into account his sheer size alone, I'm inclined to agree. Kai, of course, declined the responsibility. If I die saving your life, he said, then who's going to protect you? I eye Sakura's smudged lipstick and smirk, twisting the glass to avoid the mark before I take a sip of whiskey.
No need for pretense, says Sakura. You should just ask.
You know why I'm here, then.
The whole of Midas is talking about your siren.
Sakura leans back against the liquor cabinet.
Don't think there is a single thing that goes on here that I'm not aware of.
Her eyes are sharper than ever, and narrowed in a way that tells me there are very few of my secrets she doesn't know. A prince may have the luxury of discretion, but a pirate does not. I know that many of my conversations have been stolen by strangers and sold to the highest bidders. Sakura has been one of those sellers for a while, trading information for gold whenever the opportunity presents itself. So, of course, she was careful to overhear the man who came to me in the dead of night, speaking stories of her home and the treasure it holds. I want you to come with me. Sakura laughs, and the sound doesn't suit the grave look on her face.
Is that an order from the prince?
It's a request.
Then I deny it.
You know, I wipe at the stain on my glass. Your lipstick is smudged. Sakura takes in the print of dark red on the rim of my glass and presses a finger to her lips. When it comes away clean, she glowers. I can see her plainly now, as the thing I have always known she is. The snow-faced woman with lips bluer than any siren's eye. A blue reserved for royalty. The natives of Pagos are like no other race in the Hundred Kingdoms. but the royal family is a breed unto themselves. Carved from great blocks of ice, their skin is that much paler, their hair that much whiter, and their lips are the same blue as their seal.
Have you known for a while?
Sakura asks.
It's the reason I've let you get away with so much, I tell her. I didn't want to reveal your secret until I found a way to put it to good use. I raise my glass in a toast. Long live Princess Yukiko of Pagos.
Sakura's face doesn't change at the mention of her real name. Instead, she looks at me blankly, as though it's been so long that she doesn't even recognize her own name.
Who else knows?
She asks. I haven't told anybody yet. I emphasize the yet more crudely than necessary. Though I don't understand why you'd even care. Your brother took the crown over a decade ago. It's not like you have a claim to the throne. You can go where you like and do as you please. Nobody wants to assassinate a royal who can't rule. Sakura looks at me candidly.
I'm aware of that.
Then why the secrecy? I ask. I haven't heard anything about a missing princess, so I can only assume that your family knows where you are.
I'm no runaway,
says Sakura. Then what are you?
Something you will never be, she sneers. Free.
I set my glass down harder than I intend. How lucky for you, then. It's easy for Sakura to be free. She has four older brothers with claims to the throne before her, and so none of the responsibilities my father likes to remind me are still heavy on my shoulders.
I left once Kazuya took the crown, Sakura says. With three brothers to counsel him, I knew I'd have no wisdom to offer that they couldn't. I was 25 and had no taste for the life of a royal who would never rule. I told my brothers this. I told them I wanted to see more than snow and ice. I wanted color.
She looks at me.
I wanted to see gold.
I snort. And now?
Now, I hate the vile shade.
I laugh. Sometimes I feel the same, but it's still the most beautiful city in all of the Hundred Kingdoms.
You'd know better than me.
Sakura says. Yet you stay.
Homes are hard to find.
I think about the truth of that. I understand it better than anyone, because nowhere I've traveled ever really feels like home. Even Midas, which is so beautiful and filled with so many people I love. I feel safe here, but not like I belong. The only place I could ever call home and mean it is the sod. And that's constantly moving and changing, rarely in the same place twice. Maybe I love it because it belongs nowhere. Not even in Midas, where it was built. And yet, it also belongs everywhere. I swirl the final remnants of my whiskey and look to Sakura. So then, it would be a shame if people discovered who you were. Being a piggy's immigrant is one thing, but being a royal without a country is another. How would they treat you?
Little prince.
Sakura licks her lips.
Are you trying to blackmail your favor?
Of course not, I say, though my voice says something else. I'm simply saying that it would be inconvenient if people found out, especially considering your patrons.
For them, says Sakura. They would try to use me, and I would have to kill them. I would probably have to kill half of my customers.
I think that's bad for business.
But being a killer has worked out so well for you.
I don't react to this, but my lack of emotion seems to be the exact reaction Sakura wants. She smiles. So beautiful, even though it's so clearly mocking. I think about what a shame it is that she's twice my age, because she's striking when she's wicked. And wild underneath the pretense. Come to Pagos with me, I say.
No. Sakura turns away from me.
No, you won't come?
No, that isn't what you want to ask.
I stand. Help me find the crystal of Kito.
Sakura turns back to me.
There it is.
There is no sign of a smile on her face now.
You want a Peggy's to help you climb the Cloud Mountain and find your fairy tale?
It's not like I can just stroll in and scale your most deadly mountain with no idea of what I'll be dealing with. Will your brother even give me entry? With you by my side, you can advise me on the best course of action. Tell me the route I should take. Help convince the king to give me safe passage.
I am an expert at climbing mountains.
Sakura's voice is wholly sarcastic. You were required to do it on your 16th birthday. I try to hide my impatience. Every Peggy's royal is, you could help me.
I am so warm of heart.
I'm asking for
your begging, she says, and for something impossible. Nobody but my family can survive the climb. It's in our blood.
I slam my fist on the table. The storybooks may peddle that, but I know better. There must be another route, a hidden way, a secret kept in your family. If you won't come with me, then tell me what it is.
It wouldn't matter, either way.
What does that mean? She runs a tongue across her blue lips.
If this crystal does exist in the mountain, then it's surely hidden in the locked dome of the Ice Palace.
A locked dome, I say blankly. Are you making this up as you go along?
We are perfectly aware of the legends written in all of those children's books, she says. My family has been trying to find a way into that room for generations, but there's no other entry than the one that can be plainly seen and no way of forcing our way in. It's magically sealed, perhaps by the original families themselves. What's needed is a key, a necklace lost to our family. Without that, it doesn't matter how many mountains you bargain your way up, you'll never be able to find what you're looking for.
Let me worry about that, I say. Finding lost treasure is a specialty of mine.
And the ritual needed to release the crystal from its prison, Sakura asks. I'm assuming you found out about that, too.
Not any specifics.
That's because nobody knows them. How do you plan to conduct an ancient rite if you don't even know what it is?
In truth, I thought Sakura might be able to fill in the blanks there. The secret is probably on your necklace, I tell her, hoping it's true. It could be a simple inscription we need to read. And if it's not, then I'll figure something else out. Sakura laughs.
Say you're right, she says. Say legends are easy to come by. Say even lost necklaces and ancient rituals are too. Say maps and routes are the most elusive thing. Who's to say I'd ever share such a thing with you?
I could leak your identity to everyone. The words taste petty and childish on my lips.
How beneath you, Sakura says. Try again.
I pause. Sakura isn't refusing to help. She's simply giving me the opportunity to make it worth her while. Everyone has a price, even the forgotten Peggy's princess. I just have to find out what hers is. Money seems irrelevant, and the thought of offering her any makes me grimace. She could take it as an insult. She is royalty, after all. Or see me more as a child than a captain, which I so clearly am in her presence. I have to give her something nobody else can. An opportunity she'll never get again, and so won't dream of passing up. I think about how similar Sakura and I are. Two royals trying to escape their countries. Only Sakura hadn't wanted to leave Pagos because she disliked being a princess, but because the job had become useless once her brother took the crown. No taste for the life of a royal who would never rule. I felt a sinking sensation in my stomach. At heart, Sakura is a queen. The only problem is that she doesn't have a country. I understand, then, what my quest will cost me if I want it enough. I can make you a queen. Sakura arches a white brow.
I hope that you're not threatening to kill my brothers, she says. Because the Pegis don't turn against one another for the sake of a crown.
Not at all. I compose myself as best I can. I'm offering you another country entirely. A slow look of realization works its way onto Sakura's face. Coyly, she asks,
And what country would that be, Your Highness?
It will mean the end of the life I love. The end of the sod, and the ocean, and the world I have seen twice over and would see again 1,000 times. I would live the life of a king, as my father has always wanted, with a snowborn wife to rule by my side. An alliance between ice and gold. It'd be more than my father imagined. And wouldn't it be worth it in the end? Why will I have to search the sea once all of its monsters have been destroyed? I'll be satisfied, maybe, ruling Midas, once I know the world is out of danger. But even as I list the reasons it's a good plan, I know they're all lies. I'm a prince by name and nothing else. Even if I manage to conquer the sirens and bring peace to the ocean, I've always planned to stay on the sod with my crew if they'd still follow me. No longer searching, but always moving. Anything else will make me miserable. Staying still in one place and one moment will make me miserable. In my heart, I'm as wild as the ocean that raised me. I take a breath. I'll be miserable then, if that's what it takes. This country, if there's a map that shows a secret route up the mountain so my crew and I can avoid freezing to death during the climb, then it'll be a fair trade. I hold out my hand to Sakura, to the princess of Pagos. If you give me that map, I'll make you my queen.
13. Lyra. I've made a mistake. It started with a prince, as most stories do. Once I felt the thrum of his heart beneath my fingers, I couldn't forget it, and so I watched from the water, waiting for him to reappear. But it was days before he did, and once he had, he never neared the ocean without a legion by his side. Singing to him by the docks was risk enough, with the promise of royal guards and passers-by coming to the young hunter's rescue. But with his crew there, it was something else. I could sense the difference in those men and women in the way they followed the prince, moved when he moved, stayed still in rapt attention whenever he spoke to them. A kind of loyalty that can't be bought. They would jump into the ocean after him and sacrifice their lives for his, as though I would take such a trade. So rather than attack, I watched and listened as they spoke in stories of stones with the power to destroy worlds. The second eye of Keto, a legend my mother has been hunting for her entire reign. The humans spoke of heading to the Ice Kingdom in search of it, and I knew it would be my best opportunity. If I followed them to the Snow Sea, then the waters would be too cold for any human to survive, and the prince's crew could do nothing but watch him die. I had a plan. But my mistake was to think that my mother didn't. As I watched the prince, the sea queen watched me. And when I ventured from the Mydassan docks in search of food, my mother made herself known. The smell of desecration is ripe. A line of bodies, sharks and octopi, scatter through the water as a trail for me to follow. I swim through the corpses of animals I would have feasted on any other day. "I'm surprised you came," says the sea queen. My mother looks majestic, hovering in a circle of carcasses. Remains drip from the symbols on her skin, and her tentacles sway lethally beside her. My jaw tightens. "I can explain. I imagine you have many explanations in that sweet little head of yours," says the queen. "Of course, I'm not interested in them." "Mother." My hands curl to fists. I left the kingdom for a reason. An image of the golden prince weighs in my mind. If I hadn't hesitated on the beach and been so concerned with savoring the sweet smell of his skin, then I wouldn't need explanations. I would only need to present his heart, and the sea queen would show me mercy. "You saved a human." Her voice is as dead as night. I shake my head. "That's not true." The queen's tentacles crash into the ocean bed, and a mighty wave of sand washes over me, knocking me to the floor. I bite back a cough as the shingle catches in my throat. "You insult me with your lies," she seethes. "You saved a human, and not just any human, but the one who kills us. Is it because you live to disobey me?" she asks, and then, with a disgusted snarl, "Or perhaps you've grown weak, silly little girl, bewitched by a prince. Tell me, was it his smile that did it? Did it bring your heart to life and make you love him like some common mermaid?" My mind spins. I can barely be outraged through the confusion. Love is a word we scarcely hear in the ocean. It exists only in my song and on the lips of the princes I've killed. And I have never heard it from my mother's mouth. I'm not even sure what it really means. To me, it has always been just a word that humans treasure for reasons I can't comprehend. There isn't even a way to say it in Saurian. Yet my mother is accusing me of feeling it. Is it the same fealty I have for Kalia? That force that drives me to protect her without even thinking? If that's true, then it makes the accusation even more baffling, because all I want is to kill the prince. And though I may not know what love is, I'm sure it isn't that. "You're mistaken," I tell my mother. A corner of the queen's lips coils in revulsion. "You murdered a mermaid for him. She was trying to eat his heart." Her eyes narrow. "And why," she asks, "would that be a bad thing? Let the creature take his filthy heart and swallow it whole." "He was mine," I argue. "A gift for you. A tribute for my 18th. The queen stops to comprehend this. "You hunted a prince for your birthday," she says. "Yes, but mother." The sea queen's gaze darkens, and in an instant, one of her tentacles reaches out and snatches me from the ocean floor. "You insolent thing!" Her tentacles tighten around my throat, squeezing until the ocean blurs. I feel a shiver of danger. I'm deadly, but the sea queen is something more. Something less. "Mother," I plead. But the queen only squeezes tighter at the sound of my voice. If she wanted, she could snap my neck in two, take my head like I took the mermaid's. Perhaps even my heart, too. The queen throws me onto the ocean bed, and I grab at my throat, touching the tender spot, only to snatch my hand away as the bones crack and throb with the contact. Above me, the queen rises, towering like a dark shadow. Around us, the water dulls in color, becoming gray and then seeping to black, as though the ocean is stained with her fury. "You are not worthy to be my heir," the sea queen hisses. When I part my lips to speak, all I taste is acid. The ocean salt is replaced by burning magic that sizzles down my throat. I can barely breathe through the pain. "You are not worthy of the life you have been given." "Don't," I beg. Barely a whisper, barely a word. A crack in the air, masquerading as a voice, just like my Aunt Crestel's had before she was killed. "You think you're the prince's bane," the sea queen roars with laughter. "But you are the prince's savior." She raises her trident, carved from the bones of the goddess Keto. Bones like night, bones of magic. In the center, the trident ruby awaits its orders. "Let us see," sneers the queen, "if there is any hope for redemption left in you." She taps the base of the trident onto the floor, and I feel pain like nothing I could have imagined. My bones snap and realign themselves. Blood pours from my mouth and ears, melting through my skin. My gills. My fin splits, tearing me straight down the middle, breaking me in two. The scales that once shimmered like stars are severed in moments, and beneath my breast comes a beating I have never known. It feels like a thousand fists pounding from the inside. I clutch at my chest, nails digging in, trying to claw whatever it is out of me, set it free, the thing trapped inside and so desperately pounding to be released. Then, through it all, my mother's voice calls. "If you are the mighty prince's bane, then you should be able to steal this prince's heart, even without your voice, without your song." I try to cling to consciousness, but the ocean is choking me. Salt and blood scrape down my throat until I can only gasp and thrash. But I hold on. I don't know what will happen if I close my eyes. I don't know if I'll ever open them again. "If you want to return," growls the sea queen, "then bring me his heart before the solstice." I try to focus, but my mother's words turn to echoes. Sounds I can't make out, can't understand or bear to focus on. I've been torn apart, and it's not enough for her. My eyes begin to shut, the black of the sea blurring in the backs of my eyes. The seawater swirls in my ears until nothing but numbness remains, with a last glance at the blurry shadow of my queen. I close my eyes and give in to the darkness.
14. Elyon. The pyramid disappears behind the horizon. The sun is climbing higher, gold against gold. We sail onward, leaving the shining city behind until the ocean turns blue once more and my eyes adjust to the vast expanse of color. It always takes a while. At first, the blues are muted. The whites of the clouds dotted with bronze as leftover shimmers from Midas float across my eyes. But soon, the world comes bursting back, vivid and unyielding. The coral of the fish and the bluebell sky. Everything is behind me now. The pyramid and my family and the bargain I struck with Sakura. And in front of me, the world, ready to be taken. I clutch the parchment in my hand. The map of passageways hidden throughout the mighty Cloud Mountain, kept secret by the Pegi's royals, ensuring safety when they make their way up the mountain to prove their worth to the people. I've bargained my future for it, and all I need now is the Piggy's necklace. Good thing I know just where to look. I didn't tell my family about my engagement. I'm saving that for after I get myself killed. Telling my crew was more than enough hassle, and if their mortifying jibes hadn't been trouble enough, Madrid's outrage that I would bargain myself away had been. Spending half her life being sold from ship to ship left her with an inflexible focus on freedom in every aspect. The only comfort I could offer, and it seemed strange to be the one offering comfort in this kind of situation, is that I have no intention of going through with it. Not that I'm planning to go back on my word. I'm not that sort of a man, and Sakura is not the sort of woman who would take betrayal lightly. But there's something that can be done. Some other deal to be struck that will give us both what we want. I just need to introduce another player to the game. I stand on the quarterdeck and survey the sod. The sun has disappeared, and the only light comes from the moon and the flickering lanterns aboard the ship. Below decks, most of my skeleton crew, an apt name for my volunteers, are asleep, or swapping jokes and lewd stories in place of lullabies. The few that remain above deck are still and subdued in a way they rarely are. We are sailing toward Idilio, one of the few stops we have to make before we reach Pagos, and the very key to my plan. Idilio holds the only replacement for my hand in marriage that Sakura will consider accepting. On deck, Torek is playing cards with Madrid, who claims to be the best at any game my first mate can think of. The match is quiet, and marked only by sharp intakes of breath whenever Torek takes another smoke of his cigar. By his feet is my assistant engineer, who disappears below decks every once in a while, only to reappear, take a seat on the floor, and continue sewing the holes in his socks. The night brings out something different in all of them. The sod is home, and they're safe here, finally able to let their guards down for a few rare moments. To them, the sea is never the true danger. Even crawling with sirens and sharks and beasts that can devour them whole in seconds, the true danger is people. They are the unpredictable, the betrayers and the liars. And on the sod, they are a world away. So this map will lead us to the crystal? Asks Kai. I shrug. Maybe just to our deaths. He places a hand on my shoulder. Have some confidence, he tells me. You haven't steered us wrong yet. That just means nobody will be prepared when I do. Kai gives me a disparaging look. We're the same age, but he has a funny way of making me feel younger. More like the boy I am than the captain I try to be. That's the thing about risks, Kai says. It's impossible to know which ones are worth it until it's too late. You're getting really poetic in your old age, I tell him. Let's just hope you're right and the map is actually useful in helping us not freeze to death. I'm pretty attached to all my fingers and toes. I still can't believe you bargained away your future for a piece of parchment, Kai says. His hand is on his knife, as though just talking about Sakura makes him think of battle. Weren't you just telling me that risks can be worthwhile? Not the kind that land you in unholy matrimony with a princess. He says the last word like it's dirty, and the thought of my marrying another royal doesn't bear thinking about. You make a good point, I tell him. But I'm going to offer Sakura a better prize than myself, as unlikely as that may sound. It's the reason we're going to Idilio in the first place, so don't act so resigned to my fate just yet. I have a plan. The least you can do is have faith. Except that your plans always end in scars. The ladies love them. Not when they're shaped like bite marks. I grin. I doubt the Queen of Idilio is going to cannibalize us. There's a lot of land between us and her, says Kai. Plenty of time for me to be eaten somewhere along the way.
Despite his qualms, Kai doesn't seem put out by my evasiveness. He never seems to mind elusive retorts and vague, almost flippant answers. It's like the thrill of the hunt might just be in the not knowing. Often I've shared the sentiment. The less I knew, the more I had the chance to discover. But now, I wish I knew more than what was written in a children's book, tucked away in the desk of my cabin. The text speaks of the very top of the Cloud Mountain, the farthest point from the sea, and the palace that was made from the last frozen breath of the sea goddess Kito, a holy place that only Pegase royals are allowed to enter on their sacred pilgrimages. It's there that they sit in prayer and worship the gods who carved them. It's there they stay for 16 days. And it's there, in the center of this holy palace, that the crystal lies. Probably. This whole quest is based on rumor and hearsay, and the only upside to any of it is that the missing necklace has prevented Sakura and her family from ever getting inside the locked dome. It's not likely I'd be able to use the crystal if it was already in their possession. Just imagining the conversation with the Pegase king makes me flinch. Would you kindly allow me and my pirate crew to borrow one of the world's most powerful sources of magic for a few days? After I kill my immortal enemy, I promise I'll bring it right back. At least if I'm the one to find the crystal, it gives me the upper hand. But despite the small comfort that brings, Sakura's talk of hidden domes and lost keys in the shape of necklaces makes things trickier. If I can't find that necklace, then I've bargained everything for nothing. Then again, the fact that her family has been searching for generations without any luck doesn't mean much. After all, none of them are me.
You fancy a game?
Madrid looks up at me.
As it happens, Torek is a sore loser.
And you're a mighty cheat, says Torek. She's got cards up her sleeve.
The only thing I have up my sleeve is tricks and talent.
There,
Torek points.
You see? Tricks.
From the floor, the assistant engineer looks up at them.
I didn't see any cheating. He threads a needle through a pair of patchwork socks.
Ha!
Torek clips him around the ear half-heartedly.
You were too busy knitting.
I'm sewing, he disputes.
And if you don't want me to, I'll throw your lot overboard. Torek grunts.
Attitude, he says.
Then, to me,
all I get is attitude.
It's all you give, too, I tell him.
I give my heart and soul,
Torek protests.
My mistake, I say. I wasn't aware you had either of those things.
Beside me, Kai sniggers.
It's why he always loses, he says. No heart and so no imagination.
You be careful, I don't imagine throwing you overboard.
Torek calls up to him.
What do you think, Cap? Do we really need another siren hunter on this quest?
Kai cooks, too.
Madrid says, sorting the deck back in order. Torek shakes his head.
I reckon we can lay the nets and catch our own fish for supper. We'll grill them up nice enough without your pretty boy.
Madrid doesn't bother to reply, and just as I'm about to come back in her place, something catches my eye in the distance. A strange shadow in the middle of the ocean. A figure on the water. I squint and pull the golden telescope from my belt loop. To Kai, I say, northwest, and my friend produces a small pair of binoculars from his own belt. Do you see it? I ask. It's a man. I shake my head. Just the opposite. I squint, black-rimmed eye pressed fiercely to the looking glass. It's a girl.
What's a girl doing in the middle of the damn ocean?
Torek climbs the steps toward us. On the main deck, Madrid slots the cards back into the packet. Dryly, she says,
perhaps she's catching her own fish for supper.
Torek shoots her a look.
There are sharks out there.
perfect with rice.
I roll my eyes. Thankfully, the girl is floating and not drowning. Strangely,